I'm very pleased to welcome Adrian Rass as our next speaker. Adrian's going to be speaking on his views on underwriting risk and reinsurance risk management. A quick bio: over the last 5 years at Santam, Adrian has lived a tale of two cities. He's based in Cape Town, but especially during quarterly reporting, he comes back to Johannesburg, and apparently this is where the work actually gets done. Further to these geographical diversification benefits, Adrian has, as good risk managers do, secured for himself a role that is quite varied. His responsibilities are ERM, and he's an appointed head of risk for a number of Santam's entities, model governance and validation, contributing to Santam's recent approval of its internal model by the Prudential Authority, which is the first in Africa.
Yes.
Very cool. Group-wide underwriting reinsurance governance, and this is the topic of today's presentation. Prior to Santam, Adrian's worked at the FSB as well as a consultant across various continents. And in his actuarial career, I'm quoting verbatim, his subsequent efforts got him as far as being an associate member of the ASA and IFOA. And he cherishes this, given its implied tenuous nature. If he had a chance, he'd probably spend his days riding his bike, a sport that he's very passionate about. So definitely might win best bio drafting skills award of the day. And let me hand over to Adrian. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Ryan. I think I try to bring a bit of humor into the bio. Often they can be quite dry. And obviously also there was a bit of reference to diversification and so on that as risk management we all understand quite well. I think in my career there's at least been a few constants, one of which is that I've always worked as a non-life insurance actuary. And I think the main reason for that is that even in varsity it already really caught my attention in terms of how complex and vast it is. I mean, I can't say it's as complex as cyber risk, because that's a whole another ball game these days. But I think if you think of all the types of natural and man-made hazards that are out there in the everyday life that we live, and also the global nature of short-term insurance, if you bring in the reinsurance angle, then there's certainly enough for one lifetime to keep your curiosity going. So the objectives of today's presentation is to kind of talk you through at a very high level. I could probably spend all week, if we really get into it, to discuss the work that I've been doing at Santam as a part of my role to improve the underwriting and the reinsurance risk governance that we've set out, and I'll talk about the reasons for that just now. But really to also give you a bit of a sense of how, you know, this being an ERM presentation, how the various risk types come together and how they interact with each other and the relationships between them. I think the purpose will also be to do that in the context of Santam, which hopefully most of you are familiar with, being South Africa's largest and I think one of the oldest, certainly, if not the oldest insurers. So there's a lot of complexity in the operation that I'll speak about. Obviously, also in actuarial conferences, so, you know, the role of the actuary, and I know there's been a lot of questions about the prudential standards and what they require of the head of the actuarial function. I actually want to deliberately avoid that question because I don't like answering it, and we can talk about that afterwards. But I will give you an idea of how actuaries can contribute to this this area of work, which is very important. I think I'll give you some practical insights into, you know, the lessons I've been learning over the last 5 years to do the work, and touch on really the framework that we've been working to establish at Santam. So obviously risk is a very big topic, and my talk here today is restricted to short-term insurers, starting at a macro level, and the slide is a little bit small, but really, I think as ERM specialists, we are, I think, quite comfortable with the idea that risks overlap. You know, whatever you decide in terms of your strategy, be it your, you know, growth strategy or your investment strategy, is in one way or another going to affect the other aspects. So even one of the topics that I think a lot of us spend time on, operational risk, is kind of really permeating everything in the whole risk universe. So then maybe homing in today then on the insurance risk, which is what I'd like to talk about, is what kind of risks are there? And are they all about numbers, so claims and premiums? Well, actually, no. And I must be honest, a lot of the really interesting ones are not that that easy to pin down. So, you know, if you think about trying to unpack various issues, I think taking a step back to the strategic element, in short-term insurers, specifically in South Africa, we often grapple with good quality data, or you might sit with lines of business that are just not, don't lend themselves to being priced using actuarial methods. You know, if you think about, let's take something like a liability line of business where each risk is completely individual. I mean, how do you compare MTN to EOH? Yes, they're both technology businesses, but they're just vastly different. So how do you go about pricing their directors and officers policy? And that's where the underwriters have always, specifically in the specialist lines of business, had a bit of an advantage or a supposed advantage to actuaries. And that's an old debate, which I won't go into now. But, you know, you have to, in this kind of work, really come to terms with not being the specialist, not understanding the complexity and the risks that you're trying to address, and kind of, you know, become comfortable with placing a lot of dependence on what the underwriters have to tell you, and very quickly, you know, do these little mini crash courses in understanding the various lines when you need to unpack issues with them. I'll talk about a few of those as I go along, but I've put up there the sort of generic elements of how we look at underwriting risks and reinsurance, to maybe talk about underwriting specifically. You know, just in that whole process of assessing risk, like I said, risks that are very complex, how do you go about governing or validating whether your underwriters really know what they're doing? And even if they do, how do you come to terms with maybe the fact that those guys don't always get the data or the information that they ought to have to assess risk, right? I've spoken a little bit about the challenges of actually modeling all the risks that we underwrite, but then certainly you sit with other pressures, let's say from a commercial point of view, where you know, you've done all your actuarial modeling and it's lovely, but the market's just simply saying to you, no, we can find cover cheaper at a million other places, specifically in the current context where reinsurance has been very cheap and capital has been, you know, very readily available all over the world. Those things are changing and they do go through cycles. I think from your studies, you'll all be familiar with the insurance cycle. So these things do go through ebbs and flows. From a product point of view, and I think specifically on the niche lines of business, the more specialist things like corporate property and marine, you really got to understand your product, and also how that product interrelates with the real world out there. So when I get to my last slide, I'll talk about some of the topical issues. But, you know, the real world is a very dynamic place, and the covers that we offer try and manage those risks as best they can. But the terms and conditions become quite critical then in terms of making sure that we do take on risk that we are actually able to, you know, if you think back of the principles of insurance. In terms of reinsurance there, I mean, naturally, and a lot of it does go back to credit risk, so I won't go into that. That's not today's focus, but there are lots of operational risks that you got to be wary of. So basic things like placing facultative reinsurance on a corporate property policy that has cover of up to 6 or 8 billion rand. I mean, that if that policy was not reinsured properly, it could sink Santam in a heartbeat. If we don't pay the premium for that fac slip, could cause major problems. If there's some misunderstanding between an underwriter and the reinsurance department as to what the treaty actually allows, it could bind us on risks that we're just not comfortable with or inherently don't understand. So there might be some new exclusions that weren't properly communicated. So lots of operational risks also to be aware of. Reserving, I mean, I think we're all fairly comfortable, I think, with reserving as actuaries, but, you know, it's something a little bit more subtle. So when business managers come and go, they like to put their stamp down. So the previous manager, you know, would have driven down the reserves as hard as he possibly could to look good. And then the new guy comes along and say, no, actually the previous guy didn't know what he was doing. Let's push up the reserves. And so there's a lot of human element as well in reserving that you kind of have to watch out for. And as actuaries, you know, obviously being on top of what the data is saying is one thing, but to really also know what's going on in the business is another. I could spend a lot of time talking about claims. I mean, there's claims in various forms in non-life insurance. We've got catastrophe claims, we've got large claims, and then we've got the everyday claims that happen every day, like much like these things that we don't really perceive as major risks, like maybe a bumper basher. But what if the rent suddenly, you know, goes through the window? Those bumper bashers quickly cost us a lot of money if the parts that we need to import become overnight a lot more expensive. So, yeah, certainly a very complex category of risk. And for that reason, also, sometime, maybe if I can digress a little bit, took this step more or less 12 years ago when the financial condition reporting was first promulgated by the regulator to embark on a path to develop an internal model for the parts of insurance risk or underwriting risk that can be quantified. I think a lot of what I'm talking about today is the almost the unquantified risks, but certainly those are also worth mentioning. So, I mean, just to give you a quick sense of Suntime, I mean, it's really, I mean, we are a pipsqueak company compared to the rest of the world. I mean, we're tiny. If you start sizing up how big some of those insurers out there are, the Allianzes, the Scores, the Generalis, and so on. And yet we are incredibly complex. Yes, we are South Africa, and through some recent acquisitions with Sanlam, we've become the largest, I think, financial services group or insurance group in Africa. But despite the scale, we are incredibly complex. And I think it's a great learning school for any actuary who is interested in non-life insurance to really get to understand the different lines of business that we do, the different channels that we do it through. You can literally find combinations of each of those two factors alone at Suntime. We've embarked on a journey to diversify our risk pool across various regions. That's something which we've almost had to do because South Africa is also only so big. Excuse me, and we do have a dominant market share, which becomes increasingly difficult to actually expand on. So, because of that, from an insurance point of view, you're starting to move into territories which you got to ask yourself, are you really the expert to underwrite a Samsung cell phone factory out in Korea? You know, are the risks really the same? Are there maybe tricks that those guys can play on you when they provide you with information that you haven't thought of? You know, so and then obviously also, you know, growing places strain on the resources that are, you know, comfortable with the things they do in South Africa. So, you know, you got guys flying all around Africa, all around the Southeast. You know, they get tired. So do they always make the best decisions? You know, there's lots of human elements that you can unpack. I think just from a sort of a operational point of view, also perhaps highlight how complex it is. If you think about Suntime, you probably just think of one yellow umbrella, but there are actually lots of brands under that umbrella. If I move on to my next slide, you need to then also very quickly discern what is important, what is material, and how do you go about doing that when there aren't always numbers to back up your judgment, you know? So, data is, and when I say data, I'm not saying that sort of data that you'd use for reserving where it's quite well established, or even for our internal model, that data is of a very good quality. Certainly wouldn't have been possible for us to have our internal model approved if the data wasn't of a superior quality. But the type of data I'm talking about is at a much more granular level, you know, at a policy level, at a portfolio level. And also the sort of information that the underwriters, you know, store away in their handwritten files or in their survey reports that are not structured, they're not captured on data bases that we are so familiar with analyzing. I've spoken about the complexity and the change that keeps happening in our environment, and a little bit about the interconnectedness of the risk. All of those factors make it quite challenging to from one quarter to the next, decide what's the most important thing to speak to your next risk committee about. You know, there's always an endless choice of interesting topics, but which of those are actually going to move the needle? So I think specifically, you know, coming from a group risk function point of view, it's very important to be in touch with your underwriters, and that's why I do spend so much time up here in Joburg, because unfortunately they do sit mostly here. And really keep in touch with them. You know, it's, you can't perform this sort of job from a desk back in Cape Town. You got to pay your dues by visiting people and talking to them and keeping in touch, and also managing the personalities, which as actuaries we're not always you know, that comfortable with. So I think, you know, I'm probably hopefully not as much as the cyber guys, but giving you a sense of, you know, how overwhelming it can be to govern an organization as complex as Santam, and certainly just the insurance risk, which, yes, is core to our strategy and to our business. But, you know, it's not like we've made it to 100 years without doing anything right. So there are lots of good things that we have been doing for many years and that have developed over time. You know, the basics like having a proper board delegation of authority in place, which sets out, you know, what kind of claims can our CEO Lizay authorize, which of those need to go to the board, all the way down to Philippa sitting in the room, what kind of policy can she bind us to as our new head of commercial underwriting. So it's very important to cascade that down. You know, you get lots of new guys coming into the underwriting field that don't really understand the risks, and they need to kind of prove their worth. It's a little bit like a share trader has to kind of show that they know and understand the risks that they take on. The capital in the reinsurance management obviously plays a very important role, because you can't be doing this for the love of it. You know, you do it and it has to make financial sense, not just because we want to make profit, but because we do run a very complex, I don't want to call it a casino, but, you know, that's the best way of comparing it. There are lots of bets that we take, and we need to make sure that the casino can honor those bonuses or those winnings that or the claims that the clients, you know, are entitled to receive from us. So That then ties in very neatly with how you go about quantifying your risk appetite. You know, so there are various ways, and I think we've certainly I don't just say this to sound nice, but I think we've risk appetite is probably the one word that you hear at Santam the most, at least in the area of work that I do. So you, on a constant basis, are talking to people about what can we take on, what can't we? You know, what makes sense, what doesn't. And it's hard to get it right, because if I can quickly illustrate the point to you, if you consider a motor policy that's maybe at worst R1 million, you know, a company with 5 billion rand worth of capital can take on those risks very readily, and it's not an issue. But what about if a policy like a corporate risk has an exposure of, let's say, R1 billion after we've reinsured away the parts that we don't want? Is that R1 billion the same thing if it attaches from an excess point of, let's say, R20 million that the client stands in for, versus R1 billion that sits in an excess layer far up in the clouds, you know, where other insurers are co-insuring, or not co-insuring, but reinsuring the primary layers that you then only take part in, either as a share or, you know, as an excess layer? So risk appetite is quite complex to define just at a per risk level. In terms of exposure to risk aggregation, and I'm going to speak a little bit about those later, but I think in terms of the various things that can stack up, defining your aggregate risk appetite is also quite an ongoing discussion. Perhaps not as directly relevant, but, you know, certainly through the business planning and strategizing that we do, there's a lot of thinking and thought that goes into what the business can take on from a risk point of view. So then you'd ask, well, if you've already done all of that, why would you want to improve? Why is there a need to, you know, take it to the next level? Well, I think I haven't spoken to all the detail, but a lot of our business is actually outsourced. In fact, I think it's probably at least 50% of our business comes from channels or subsidiaries or UMAs that don't sit at our head office. You know, they spread all across Illovo and Four Ways and, you know, the rest of Joburg. We don't have direct control over them as one would with underwriters that sit at head office or in your branches. So there's a lot of there's a need to really understand those activities that the underwriters perform. And I've spoken about the growth outside of South Africa. That adds naturally a lot of additional risk and complexity. There've been a couple of losses or events that have made us to also, you know, it's not fundamental stuff that'll cause Santam to fail from an underwriting point of view. You know, those sort of risks we understand relatively well, or as well as we can. You know, earthquake risk is our main solvency risk from an underwriting point of view, and we can reinsure against it, and we've got a model to try and quantify that as best as is possible. But nevertheless, you know, on a more lower return period basis, there's lots of things. If you think about listeriosis, that cost us a couple of R100 million. If you think about Knysna, R1.5 billion, obviously the reinsurers had to pay their share. But there are lots of things. The Grayston Bridge caused, I think, as many as 4 of our business units that operate completely independently to have to pay. Liability, engineering, property, the reinsurance, Santa Maria to pay. So one incident can actually cause a lot of things to, or cause a lot of claims to have to be paid. I've spoken about the reserve risk that you need to always keep an eye on, specifically on the reinsurance and the liability lines. But then also the operational incidents. I think given the fact that underwriting is such a human-driven activity, you got to really understand how much scope there is for things to go wrong, where you'll pick it up in your claims, but it's actually an operational process or control that failed. So what we've done is to, first of all, and I think obviously the regulatory changes were the impetus for us to formalize a lot of these things, but certainly not the only reason why we did it. So in terms of our underwriting and our reinsurance policies, we've got group policies, which we cascade down into our subsidiaries. So the likes of Anton and our other colleagues at Centric have to a large extent adopt what we as a group have defined as, you know, the risk limits, or at least operate within those. We set out the roles and responsibilities and the key controls and the minimum standards, which then at a business unit level need to be articulated more clearly. So effectively, we've got, I think, approximately 20 different business units. So I'm not talking about licenses or UMAs. I'm talking about business units that operate in various lines of business in various territories. So each of those needs to have a very clear understanding of what we are actually allowing them to do. We're not telling them how to do it. That's also where we rely on them. They're the specialists. But they do need to understand what we are comfortable with them doing. A lot of that does get dictated from what the reinsurance treaties provide and allow. But there are then also the cases, always the need to be nimble and innovative. And then there needs to be clear rules around how do you deviate from what the mandate is. And don't take that for granted. You know, people don't typically come to group in Belleville and ask you if they want to, you know, do something slightly differently. They get on with it and then, like, ask you for permission or apologies a year or two later when the claims have happened. So I've spoken about the risk appetite limits, and I think that's very well embedded. We've certainly put a lot of effort into making sure that they are well understood. But, you know, again, coming back to the complexity, the underwriters get on with their day jobs, they make decisions, they rely on the information that's available to them, but they don't always document how they do it and what their guidelines are. To a certain extent, it's because it's constantly changing, so it's difficult to keep a guideline alive. But nevertheless, you know, when we, from a risk or an audit point of view, come and have discussions with them, we do need to kind of know what it is that they do and don't allow within their mandate. So that's an aspect that we've been driving quite hard. I hope this is all legible, but essentially another area which I think has, I've said it's an enhancement, but it's something which has actually grown quite organically, or it's evolved quite naturally, that we have actuarial involvement and actuarial functions actually permeating right through our operations. So on our board, we've got actuaries, independent actuaries. In fact, I think Temba used to sit on our board. Our CEO happens to be an actuary. In our business units, we've got actuaries, doing support functions, but also running some of those. Our new chief risk officer and our chief underwriting officer are both actuaries. And within the functions that they fulfill, there are actuaries really throughout the whole structure. So I think that does demonstrate that, to give comfort to the board that your reinsurance, your underwriting policies are appropriate, cannot really just sit on one person. So I'm taking a bit of a contrarian view here on what maybe the regulations require, but it's a lot more complex than just one person giving an opinion. So I think appreciate also then how much collaboration is needed. So as an example, and I'll try and get this laser pointer to work, but we've got an actuary who does claims fraud modeling, using predictive methods, who has to work quite closely with our fraud and forensics team, who do a lot more of the qualitative work. In terms of the work that our FRM, our financial risk management department, does with the models, they need to also rely on the reinsurance department and Santam Re when they look at modeling the risks that business unit takes on. In terms of the work that I do, I work for the chief risk officer, but I have to, be quite close to the chief underwriting officer in terms of what takes place in all of the various functions. Ron, I've got two slides left, so I'll try and speed it up a bit. I think this is pretty much the last one. So I think what this all has culminated in is what we've called the Group Underwriting and Reinsurance Risk Forum, which is a collection of actuaries, underwriters, and business functions such as audit and risk that come together currently on a quarterly basis. We're still finding our feet in terms of what the best approach is to be effective, but we're trying to, through the various work streams that we've got, drive, the things that need to happen at a high level, the governance, the policies and the practices that need to be put in place, discussing what risk appetite means and whether changes are needed. To be clear, the forum doesn't make any decisions. So the forum won't suddenly say, okay, we can write risks up to 200 million per risk, or, accept catastrophes of up to 500 million. It's mainly an advisory or a discussion type forum that then feeds into the various decision-making channels that go all the way to the board and the risk committee. I think maybe this is also something to maybe focus on then, is there's a lot of topical issues that we've focused on specifically, also in kind of finding our feet in terms of getting everyone together. So there's been a lot of discussion happening around silent cyber and what that means for our policies, our conventional policies that don't necessarily intend to cover the types of risks that the previous speakers spoke to, when those sort of events affect our clients and lead to property or liability losses. The water crisis certainly kept us very busy because it made everyone quite anxious as to what it might mean for firefighting. And our firefighting is also another topic where supposedly the municipalities don't all have the capacity. If you look at what happened in St. Francis, you sometimes find that the firefighters are just too far away. So there's lots of things. Some of the sectors like construction and mining are really bleeding or have bled out. So that has had some real implications for us in terms of both being able to grow the business, but also, what kind of claims we then see flowing out of those sectors. We try and coordinate the assurance work. So I think one of the later speakers will speak about combined assurance. I've steered clear of that a little bit, but there's a lot of need to kind of collaborate and make sure that audit and risk and business have in place the right controls and don't duplicate one another, and that also the right skills and experience and expertise and capacity can be managed. You know, I certainly don't know everything about a facultative reinsurance process, but my audit colleagues have done a lot of work on that, so they'd be better placed to go and look at that, and so forth. Something which is still quite new, but we are also driving that through our ongoing efforts to collect better underwriting data through the exposure management stream, is to also then inform management action. So we've got a couple of segments of business that we're revisiting where it's a line or a type of peril that runs across numerous business units that we need to then analyze and get everyone's input to hopefully then also make sure that there's a consistent approach and that all the business units are operating on a level playing field. I've exhausted my time, so I'm going to hand back to Ronald. But thank you very much for listening, and I hope that's been useful.
So we have time for one or two questions from the audience for Adrian. So who'd like to ask something?
Thanks, Adrian. I'm not sure if this is relevant because I'm coming at it from a life perspective.
Okay.
And also where you operate on the African continent. But some countries have compulsory cessions for reinsurance. And I'm quite interested to know whether that's an issue, how you deal with it, do you manage the risk around it, just your general approach.
No, very good question, and I want to almost expand on it slightly to say that compulsory cession is one of those where you kind of forced to do business a certain way in Africa. Others are, which is something we're currently grappling with, is writing business that's sanctioned or where asbestos is kind of still accepted. So you'd think that a lot of those things are sorted out already, but they actually aren't. But no, compulsory cessions are very much a reality, even in a country like Namibia, where it's been a real burning point for the finance ministry and for the NAMIBRI, which is their national reinsurance business. Quite bizarrely, oftentimes those risks get circulated back or out of that country. So oftentimes we find that NAMIBRI, for instance, would take a compulsory cession and then reinsure it back to our competitors in South Africa, which almost defeats the point a little bit. But no, that is something which does take up a lot of time in the business, to devise ways of keeping the regulators and the governments happy, but still operationally being able to get on with things. Certainly, there's also a lot of credit risk that goes with that. Then, yeah.
One more for Adrian.
Scraping the bottom of the barrel here. Ron, underwriters are wonderful people, I'm sure, but like actuaries, they perhaps run the risk of being confused by their own brilliance, or forget to question the models that they're using.
Sure.
What do you do when you're sincerely not convinced that they understand the risks that they are assessing?
Yeah. Sorry. It's a very good question, and I, when I find the time one day, I could probably write a few books about my dealings with underwriters over the last 5 years. It certainly does test your interpersonal skills on a whole another level. But to kind of come to the heart of it, I mean, it is a very challenging job to stay abreast of what the real risks are, specifically because even as an actuary, if data doesn't actually exist, how do you then invalidate what an underwriter is telling you? But having said that, I think the need to have those regular discussions and almost get to a point where the underwriter gets on your side, so as not to, it has to be a healthy debate, but to not try and be confrontational in your approach, you know, kind of accept that you don't know everything about their line of business, but then start a conversation where healthy debates, that's what I like to do, is to just cultivate a healthy debate with the underwriters where you can throw around ideas and help them challenge their thinking, but then also get cooperation from them, whether it be something as simple as sharing data with you or being willing to cooperate in a study that you're busy doing.
Okay, Adrian, thank you so much.
Cool.
Here's a small token from the Actuarial Society.
Thank you.